This is Mark Strassman, reporter with SolarWorld. We're about to speak with Craig O'Hare, who's the Special Assistant for Renewable Energy in the government of the state of New Mexico. Welcome to SolarWorld.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we focus first on your place in the structure of New Mexico's government. You're the Special Assistant for Renewable Energy. Who do you report to? Where does that fit into the larger governmental structure picture there in New Mexico?
Sure. I was appointed by Governor Bill Richardson to champion his clean energy goals, both renewable energy and energy efficiency. I'm actually housed over in our Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department, and I answer directly to our Cabinet Secretary, so that's sort of where I fit into the chain of command, if you will.
Okay, what's your mission as the Special Assistant for Renewable Energy? What are you supposed to be doing?
Well, like I said, it's basically promoting the governor's clean energy goals. Those, in particular, are focusing on solar energy, energy efficiency by the utilities, getting green building going throughout the state, energy efficient green building, and getting state government to lead by example with respect to incorporating clean energy technologies into its buildings and practices.
How big a consumer of energy is the state government of New Mexico?
Pretty good size. I can't tell you off the top of my head what the megawatt hours are, but we're pretty significant within the load of New Mexico.
And would you say that the government itself uses renewables to at a higher level than the overall percentage within the energy consumption patterns of New Mexico?
Well, not yet, but that's our mission is to change that, both with respect to energy efficiency and with respect to getting some more solar deployed throughout our facilities.
Okay, so there are active programs in place now that are working to do that.
Well, yes, and we have a piece of legislation that was a stone's throw away from getting adopted last legislative session that we're going to be pursuing again. We call it clean energy revenue bonds, and it essentially will allow us to do a lot of energy efficiency and solar energy improvements to our existing buildings and actually use the energy bill savings that are associated with those improvements to pay the debt service on the bonds.
Right, exactly, right. In other words, spend the money now, save money on an ongoing basis, and then pay the bonds back with that.
Yeah, exactly. Capture those savings and then pay the bonds back with that. So that's pretty exciting, and we hope to get that adopted next legislative session. And in the interim, we were able to get $2.6 million allocated to essentially greening up existing state buildings. And we're working on some biomass projects, some solar, and some energy efficiency improvements. And this is both for state buildings and also for public schools, which are significantly funded by state funds.
Okay. I think we're going to talk about this in more depth below, but say a little bit about it now in terms of the legislation you said that almost passed. What are the political forces within the legislature and more generally in New Mexico that around energy issues? Is there a powerful pro-solar lobby? Are there forces that feel that's not a good idea? What's the landscape in terms of the politics of energy?
Sure. I would say that the legislature is still on a learning curve about the benefits of clean energy and promoting clean energy, both energy efficiency and renewable energy.
What's the argument against energy efficiency and renewables that some people make?
There's not so much an argument against energy efficiency. It's just to have programs that stimulate these things, whether they're energy efficiency or they're renewable energy. Generally, they involve two different things in isolation or in combination. Either some form of a mandate, which we have in the form of an RPS in the state, or funds to help provide incentives to make, say, photovoltaics happen.
Okay, so in other words, the government either has to say you must do this percentage of renewable or this level of energy efficiency, or it has to allocate money.
Yes, I mean, I like to say in making these things happen and getting, you know, from status quo to where we'd like to be, you know, in a lot of ways, it really just boils down to what I call money and mandates.
Now, are the same groups or individuals who don't like mandates, don't like spending money, or are they separate? Philosophically or practically separate?
They can be the same. It depends on where we're trying to get the funds. If we're trying to raise revenue, say, by way of electric bill through a public benefits charge, which, as you know, a number of other states have, well, then, of course, some of the large electricity users are not wild about rates being, you know, even a little bit affected by adding a public benefits charge. In fact, we tried to get a public benefits charge adopted in the 2003 session, and the large industrial electric consumers came out against that.
What exactly is that public benefits charge?
Well, a lot of states that actually primarily through electricity restructuring and deregulation, as part of that, they adopted, some call them systems benefit charges, some call them public benefits charges, and they levy in the neighborhood of up to 1% on electric bills to generate funds that, in most cases, the state manages to fund all sorts of various clean energy programs, whether it's a buy-down program for photovoltaics, whether like New Jersey has, or whether it's rebate programs for buying energy-efficient appliances.
What's a buy-down program?
Buy-down is essentially almost like a rebate. It's a form of subsidizing. Some of the states have a buy-down program where they subsidize photovoltaic installations to the tune of, say, $4 per watt.
Right.
So instead of, say, an installed cost of maybe $10 per watt, you actually give the property owner doing the photovoltaic installation a $4 per watt check, if you will, so that their net cost is $6 per watt, and that serves as the incentive for them to actually install it. So we were not successful at getting a public benefits charge to help fund a program like that, because the large electricity users weren't wild about the impacts on the bill.
Without calling undue attention to them, who are those large energy producers, either as a genre or companies? And they wouldn't ironically be any of the national labs we're going to talk about in a few minutes, are they?
No, they weren't the national labs. We have two large oil refineries in the state that use a lot of electricity.
Right.
There's an organization called the New Mexico Industrial Energy Consumers.
Right.
And so they're the large ones. We have Intel, an Intel plant in this state.
It takes a lot of electricity to make chips.
Yeah, we've got copper mines.
Right.
So, it's those users. Now, our public benefits charge was going to be in the neighborhood of between 0.25% and 0.5%.
Right.
But, you know, they still were saying that it would render the rates less than competitive.
You think that copper mines can't threaten to go elsewhere, though, can they?
That's right. The problem is the copper mines are very marginal these days in our state. In fact, they're closing. So any cost impact was not well received.
Okay.
So then we need to look for generating funds elsewhere, and, of course, in this day and age, it's very difficult to do anything to raise revenue that even vaguely resembles a tax.
Right.
And so there's the constraint, is that while the legislature is not inherently against a number of these programs, they're not inclined to adopt legislation that in one form or another, you know, looks or is a tax increase.
Right.
And our state budget is very, very tight. And so that, you know, the money part of the money or mandates is a real challenge to figure out how can we get some substantive funding allocated to making these things happen.
Okay, maybe we'll get back to that. Let's leave the political realm and get a little bit more into the technical and scientific.
Well, let me add one more thing to the political realm, because it's very relevant in our state.
All right.
And that is, this is a huge oil, natural gas, and coal state. It's a huge fossil fuel state as far as our state's economy.
Right.
And so there is that orientation, that mindset, if you will, within a good chunk of our legislators. And that's where I said they're sort of still on a learning curve of recognizing that clean energy technologies are not just something that the tree huggers are for, but that they represent substantive economic development potential, particularly when the writing's on the wall that, and in particular with oil and gas, that we're only looking at another 50 or 60 years of that resource.
Right.
And then we are out. So, you know, we try to, you know, make the argument that this is all about transition. This is not about getting rid of oil and gas. This is about starting a transition in our state's economy of you know, making room for renewable energy and energy efficiency, and in some ways sort of rationing what oil and gas we have So we can make this transition without it being disastrous 50 or 60 years from now when we run out of oil and gas.
Interestingly enough, that was my final culminating question at the end. We'll come back to it again.
Okay.
Let's talk about how New Mexico ranks in terms of the sunlight it receives. Is New Mexico a particularly sunny state?
It is. We are number two in solar resource potential, right behind Arizona.
Okay. Which you're right next to.
That's correct.
Say just a little bit about the physics or the engineering part about how solar electricity, photovoltaic power, is generated by the photovoltaic process.
Well, I'm not an engineer, and so I'm like a policy administrative guy, so
right.
you're not talking to the right guy to get into the technical aspects of photovoltaics.
Okay.
I'll pass on that one.
Okay. Right next to that, is in terms of questions, though, is Los Alamos and Sandia Labs. You have two big important national laboratories there in New Mexico. What contributions are they making to enhancing solar energy production or to furthering solar research within the state, if they are?
Well, they are. Los Alamos National Lab does not do a lot in the arena of solar. However, Sandia National Lab does a lot. They have a program focusing on both concentrating solar power, which is the large, more utility-scale solar power,
right.
And then they also do research in photovoltaics as well, in concert with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Boulder, Colorado, which is an arm of the U.S. Department of Energy. So there's a lot of research R&D work that's being done by Sandia National Lab in concert with NREL and USDOE.
Does that give New Mexico any kind of priority to test or use those technologies that are developed there, or are they kind of isolated within their own game?
Well, I don't want to say they're isolated, but the fact that they're physically located here certainly allows us to take advantage of their expertise, their staff expertise, and also I think serves as an attraction to other companies that are interested in doing some solar related R&D work. And in fact, I don't know the specifics of it, but there has been some sort of contract or agreement worked out where Sharp Solar Corporation is going to be coming in and working with Sandia National Lab on some some solar R&D work.
Yeah, in the same way that Triangle Research Park and Stanford and Air Force bases sort of seed the areas around them with high technology, is Sandia doing that for solar?
Yeah, I would say that's a fair statement.
Okay.
And they're also doing it in the area of hydrogen as well.
Okay. Well, next time we'll talk about hydrogen. We're focusing on when I come back from Hydrogen World, we'll talk about that. But you've got a program called Million Solar Roofs Program. There's a nice picture here on your website showing a little house with some solar panels on it. What's the picture out in the more rural areas, off-grid areas that may not even have reliable electricity? What's the state government doing to electrify them with photovoltaics?
Well, right now it's very limited because we don't have an incentive program in place that where we have that funding. I mean, that's the reality is that $10 per watt of power is really hard to get entities to adopt.
Right.
And so that's my, again, I'm the policy administrative legislative guy.
Right.
For the department. I'm a lobbyist on all these issues. And that's job one, is we have got to put in place, and this is a high priority for Governor Richardson, we've got to establish the foundation upon which to build these programs. And the foundation basically is either funding or some form of requirements. Like I mentioned, we do have a renewable portfolio standard that requires our investor-owned utilities to have renewable energy.
Right.
So that's the mandate side of the equation. But we are actually addressing the issue you just asked about through a task force that Governor Richardson will be appointing. We're calling it our Distributed Solar Task Force.
Right.
And we hope that will get off the ground in the next 3 weeks or so. And its main focus will be what sort of incentives can everybody agree to that will serve to stimulate photovoltaic deployment, both in the rural areas where there, some of the folks may be off grid, particularly on Native American lands,
right.
And also in regular urban applications as well. One thought is that because we have a renewable portfolio standard, if we could get the utilities to adopt at least pursue at least a certain small percentage of meeting that RPS requirement.
What's RPS?
I'm sorry, renewable portfolio standard.
Okay.
We have to have 10% renewable energy by 2011.
Right.
By our utilities. It's 5% beginning in 2006.
And what is it now?
It's not anything now.
Oh, okay.
The first compliance date is 2006, where they have to have 5%.
Okay. Does it look like they're going to make it?
Yeah, well, our major investor-owned utility has already made it. They've got a 204 megawatt wind farm that they're already using.
Right.
So they're set for a little while.
Right.
It looks like the utilities are making plans to be there.
Okay. Well,
the photovoltaic proposal would be if they were to carve out say 10 to 20 megawatts and say, okay, we're going to have that much be photovoltaics, then they would, and this is just conceptual. But they would then offer this buy-down program, provided that they could get cost recovery through our utility commission.
Right.
And that's the $64,000 issue that, frankly, we're going to be dealing with in the next couple of months, because our utility commission is working on rulemaking right now around those types of issues.
So that's where the political focus is going to turn to now, utility commission.
A backdrop with my economist hat on to all of this, making renewables happen in New Mexico, is the reality that we have very cheap electric rates compared to other places around the country. And so you've got renewables competing with pretty inexpensive electric power, primarily due to the fact that we've got inexpensive coal-fired electric power.
Right.
So when you've got rates at 7 cents a kilowatt hour, it's hard to make a photovoltaic that's 20 to 22 cents a kilowatt hour look attractive without significant incentives.
And is that that low-cost coal-fired electricity based on any kind of subsidies, or just on the plenitude of coal in the country, in the state?
Well, it's not just in the state, but it's in the country.
Right.
Those are old plants that are pre a lot of the the Clean Air Act requirements. So you've got these old plants that, from an air quality emission standpoint, are not ideal. And so it renders them very, very inexpensive, even though, of course, they're imposing costs on society through what
that aren't being amortized into the calculation.
Yeah, well, the economist calls those obviously externalities.
Yes, that's right.
So when you're looking at less than 2 cents per kilowatt hour coal-fired power,
right,
you're not taking into consideration the release of CO2, mercury,
right,
NOx, SOx.
Right. So if all that were factored in and they were forced to pass that along, what would their costs go up to?
Well,
as an economist,
the way to look at that is that if we were to do state-of-the-art coal-fired electric power production, say we were to decommission those plants,
right,
and say they're no longer acceptable in our society for both public health and global reasons,
right,
the ideal technology these days is what's called integrated gasification combined cycle.
I got it.
Where you essentially gasify the coal,
right,
and then burn it like it's natural gas.
Right.
And some of this is still sort of in the R&D phase, but that technology also allows the opportunity to capture the carbon, the CO2,
right,
and sequester that.
And how much does that end up costing?
Well, that's kind of a $64,000 question, but numbers that I've sort of, people have told me, are in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour.
Right.
So all of a sudden, you've got, obviously, wind coming in below that,
right,
although it's not dispatchable. And then you've got solar. I'm working on a large scale.
I'm sorry, what's dispatchable?
Dispatchable is the ability to crank up the power to meet demand.
Right, okay.
You know, you can't store electricity, so now you've got to, as demand rises and falls, you've got to be able to fire up your peaker plants when it's, you know, hot during the summer at 2 in the afternoon.
Right. And you can pour more coal in, but you can't pour more wind in. Because
exactly. You can't flip a switch and make the wind blow.
Right.
But that's the nice thing about this project that I'm working on. It's called Concentrating Solar Power.
Right.
Is that the utility scale solar electric facility. It's not photovoltaics. And it has the potential to be dispatchable. In other words, it has the potential to generate electricity at night through thermal storage.
Oh, you store it in hot salt.
There you go. Exactly what you do, and then you can you stir that hot salt or make it hot essentially during the day,
right.
And then you draw off of it at night to produce steam and spin a turbine.
Right. So you can almost say crank up the mirrors and get more power, although it's cranking up the salt or pouring.
Yeah, I mean, you could have a solar electric generating station that during the day was both taking that heat and producing electricity and directly serving the grid.
Right.
And some of it was going into your molten salt thermal storage, such that after the sun sets, you literally could have a 24/7 dispatchable energy product.
Does it generate the electricity during the day by photovoltaics or
no,
it's
by, still solar
by, heat, by heated by heated heated solar?
You're heating a fluid that then you send off to a heat exchanger and introduce water. It flashes the steam, and then you spin a turbine.
Okay.
Yeah, a plant like that's been operating in California for over 15 years. There's about 350 megawatts of what's called parabolic trough solar thermal in the deserts of California.
Now, I've become almost conversant here in talking about the price. What is electricity cost generated by one of those?
Well, right now it's expensive. But there are projections that if we can get enough of this deployed through economies of scale, we can bring it down dramatically. So right now, if you were to go out and build, say, let's say 100-megawatt parabolic trough plant, you might be talking 14 to 16 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, there are studies that have been done by DOE that says that if we can get 2,000-plus megawatts of this stuff deployed, we could be talking 6 to 8 cents per kilowatt hour.
So there's a real cost benefit per kilowatt if you deploy a larger or more implementations of the technology.
Basically, it's through the classic economies of scale.
Right.
If you go to a vendor and say, "I only want you to build a 100-megawatt plant," he's not going to be able to gear up his whole, you know, operations.
Right.
But if you say, "Hey, we got 2,000 megawatts of components for you to manufacture," all of a sudden the cost comes down dramatically.
Because essentially it's whatever the fixed or sunk costs are in building the assembly plant to do it.
Yep.
And once you've done that, the marginal cost of the additional units is less.
That's correct. And so a combination of economies of scale, technological improvements that just happen along the way,
right.
And operational improvements that happen once you build these things and get a feel for them.
Right. Otherwise known as the learning curve.
The learning curve, and that's exactly what happened in wind. I mean, some people don't realize that, 15 plus years ago, wind was up above 20 cents a kilowatt hour.
And now?
Now it's about, it's coming in at less than 5.
So that's a 75% decrease
in price. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, now, wind is now competitive with natural gas-fired electric power. Its only constraint is that it's not dispatchable.
Right.
But so there are many who believe, and I believe this to be true, that solar thermal, large scale CSP, concentrating solar power, is poised to experience the same dramatic cost reductions that wind experienced. We just need to get over the hump, if you will, of getting enough of this deployed, and that's where the public sector comes in with what I call bridging incentives to get us from A to B. Provide these incentives to basically use as a bridge to get us from the fact that it's expensive now, but if we can get enough of it out there, it'll be competitive and won't need those incentives anymore.
Right. You're essentially saying that concentrated solar generation comes in at about 14, 15 cents a kilowatt?
Yeah.
And you're saying that it could experience the same decrement in price as wind, so that would bring it down to about 5 cents. If
6 to 8 cents, but that's with thermal storage and therefore dispatchability.
Right.
So in that sense, it has a leg up on wind.
Right.
And in concert, actually, they would work very well together. I mean, literally, if you had with concentrating solar power with thermal storage and therefore dispatchability, the entire country could be powered between wind turbines and solar thermal.
Say that again.
Well, if you have a 24/7 dispatchable solar energy product with thermal storage, there's enough solar in the southwestern states, and there's enough wind in the midwestern states, particularly the Dakotas.
Right,
you could power the entire country.
You meet all of the energy needs of the United States.
Complete. All of the energy needs. You could shut down every nuclear plant and fossil fuel plant in the country. If you had the deserts of Arizona, Nevada, California, and New Mexico focusing on generating solar electric power with probably solar thermal, although dish engine technologies have their place as well. And then the Midwest is where you've got all your incredible wind, the Plain States. New Mexico actually ranks 12th in the nation in wind potential because of we've got all of eastern New Mexico is are the plains.
Would that deal with transportation energy as well?
Well, no. I mean, we're talking electricity here now.
Okay.
But you could start to talk transportation if you wanted to start talking about hydrogen.
Right. And that electricity can be converted into hydrogen.
Yeah, through through electrolysis, you can use electricity to split hydrogen off of oxygen from water.
And then fuel the cars or the vehicles with the hydrogen.
You can fuel them directly with hydrogen, or you can fuel them with a fuel cell.
Oh, or make them electric.
You can go either way. You can go fuel cell or you can go hydrogen. Some of the car manufacturers are talking about directly combusting the hydrogen, and some are using the hydrogen to feed to a fuel cell, and then essentially it's an electric.
Okay. Now, there's also a mention somewhere in your site about hybrid gas solar generators that use the gas and solar. Is this what you've been talking about when you talk about the liquid salt and...
No.
And using that, or is a hybrid gas solar generator something different?
Well, that's something different. I mean, because the powertrain of a solar thermoelectric power plant is identical to, more or less, to a fossil fuel one.
Right.
You're making steam and you're spinning a turbine. You can have a hybrid plant that, instead of the thermal storage to make it dispatchable, you link it up with, say, natural gas.
Right. So it burns gas when it's at night. And it
there you go.
And it uses solar during the day.
Yep, and in fact, there are some options to take an existing fossil fuel plant and repower it with a solar element.
Say that part again?
You can take an existing fossil fuel plant
right.
and add a solar element to it and essentially augment the steam production with heat generated from the solar.
Okay, that's another
option. So that's another option. We are embarking on a feasibility study to identify a viable utility-scale CSP plant by the end of the year. The governor established a task force. I've just finished hiring a consulting firm to pull all the pieces of the puzzle together. And by the end of the year, we hope to identify a project that's viable, including possibly any public incentives the state might need to offer to make it viable.
Could these mass solar farms and wind farms be implemented without degrading the environment in which they appear?
In other words,
if you cover vast areas of the desert with this, is it going to sort of foul up the ecology out there?
Well, they do take up space, but the space is actually comparatively small given the amount of desert we have.
Right.
And certainly if you want to talk about environmental impacts, they pale in comparison to fossil fuel plants.
Okay.
Even if we were to make coal-fired electric power as clean as possible, A, it still has emissions, and B, you're still strip mining coal.
Right.
People forget about the fact that you got to go get the coal somewhere, and what you're doing to watersheds with that is incredible.
Okay.
A solar plant runs about, I believe, 5 acres per megawatt.
Right.
But I forget the numbers off the top of my head, but there was some incredible number, like if you had a 30 mile square, in other words, 30 mile by 30 mile.
Right.
Solar area,
right.
You could like power the entire West.
All right.
I mean, it's some unbelievable number. So yeah, sure, they take up space, and yes, you know, that certainly impacts wildlife habitat. There's actually the ability for the desert plants to continue to grow around them as they grow around wind turbines.
Right.
But yeah, in the space that they take up, that's certainly displacing wildlife habitat.
All right.
But I think as far as environmental impacts go, of course, they don't have any emissions.
Right.
And and they're obviously their fuel is free and eternal.
Okay. Yes. All right. I want to talk about that more, but I'd like to keep going here, but I have to go talk to somebody else in the state government here.
Yep.
10 minutes ago. But let me just ask one last sort of economic political question. What about jobs? What's the potential of renewables and solar in particular to generate jobs that can't be outsourced and jobs that are of benefit to the economy and the population?
They're very significant, both significant in three senses. From the standpoint of constructing the facilities in the first place, then from operating the facilities, and then what we're really focusing on in New Mexico is we'd like to get the manufacturing of those components in this state as well.
Right.
So there was a, in fact, that's an arm of our feasibility study, is to do an economic impact benefit analysis of what sort of job creation and business startup creation benefits will accrue from building facilities like these solar plants. There was a study in Nevada that looked at 100 megawatt facilities, and the job creation was substantial. And that's really, you know, what we believe sells this. As I mentioned earlier, with some policymakers, to say that it's good for the environment and to have the environmentalists come in and say we need to do more of this actually is a turnoff for them. But the reality is that this is all about economic development, and this is a big focus of our state economic development department. And Governor Richardson is promoting clean energy and clean technologies, not only on their environmental benefits, but just as importantly on their economic development benefits as well.
Okay, now the oil and the coal are eventually going to run out. They were laid down millions of years ago.
Yes.
The sun has another 500 billion years or so to go. No, not 500 billion. It has several...
long enough.
Three or 4 billion years to go. What about this, as you close, bring it back to that transition, and what you see is how your efforts are going to be focused on bridging this transition from the oil age to the renewable age, and the strategy you're pursuing to do that, and why it's essential to do it now while there's enough energy to carry out that transition.
Well, basically, it's essential to do it now because of what you just said. I mean, if we don't do anything until our fossil fuel resources are gone, well, then we're going to be in crisis mode. So, you know, it's sort of like having a diversified investment portfolio. You know, you don't put all your eggs in one basket, and we've got them pretty much all in fossil fuel right now. And our strategy is through these various incentives and a little bit of requirements, like the RPS, to make all of this happen through deployment. The more we can make these technologies, get them out of the lab, if you will, and deploy throughout the state, the costs will come down, and they will begin to take off on their own.
And of course, if New Mexico becomes a place, either or both of which, where you're manufacturing these components for other states to do it, or you're building plants, solar plants of your own that allow you to export electricity, that's certainly going to help the economic development picture in New Mexico, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And our legislators, policymakers, and folks in economic development are starting to understand that because of that 204-megawatt wind farm that I mentioned, and that was a big shot in the arm and still is to our state's economy. And now they realize that this is not just about, you know, saving the environment and, you know, saving birds and trees and stuff, but it really is about job creation and you know, new businesses and things like that.
And to a certain extent, there's a new first mover advantage. The states that move the fastest and most effectively are going to sort of get the market share, the mind share.
Well, that's our objective, is to position ourselves to get out in front of it so things start to happen in this state before they happen elsewhere, and New Mexico wants to become the basically the Saudi Arabia of solar energy.
Okay, that's a very
both in generation and in manufacturing.
Right, that's an admirable goal. I am assuming you're going to have a more level economic distribution of the income there than they do in Saudi Arabia. You're already set up with your flag, of course, which has a Native American.
That's the Zia Sun symbol.
Yes, and tell us how that fits into the whole picture. The flag, the image there, and why that's a good representation of becoming the Saudi Arabia of solar.
Well, basically because it's been our flag since 1912,
right.
And here it is, you know, emphasizing, showcasing the thing we're talking about, which is solar power.
Right.
So it's very fortuitous. It's like we didn't have to go out and create our own logo because our flag is our logo for solar power.
And in fact, without getting too mushy or spiritual or sun-hugging about it, it does reflect a certain willingness and intensity of living with the natural world and taking advantage of it and living in harmony with it and benefiting from it, which is what at least an idealized picture of Native American ideas are, and seems to be where you're headed back again, too.
That's very true. I mean, we've got this incredible resource, you know, beating down on us every day.
Right.
We might as well take advantage of it.
All right. Thanks for letting me take advantage of what you know to help inform our listeners, and I'm hoping I'll get back to you again going forward to talk about further developments.
Sounds good. It was my pleasure to be on your show.
And mine to have you here. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.